Then listen to PDA by Interpol. Are you trying to make like
the I don't know what I was trying to do there, but I thought it was kind of
like,
nice.
Like drum beats over this type of music, like that gives like
it kind of gives the song we're just listening to.
Does it?
A little bit, you know. But it's
yeah.
Yeah, right?
It reminds me,
new job is a little bit.
It reminds me of like early like the late 2010s actually.
Yeah.
Like 2018, 2019.
Yeah.
It's PDA by Interpol, and then Down on a Hole by Alice in Chains.
I'm learning PDA on bass right now.
Nice, dude.
Very, very sleek bass line. The bass lines on that album are kind of like... What I really like about that album, I'm going to nerd out a little bit.
Go for it.
I just really got into it in the last month, is that there's this kind of level of like monotony to a lot of the instrumentation, which is not like a bad thing. It's just very much like the post-punk kind of vibe.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
like,
of course.
You know, it's produced to like, it's produced to the point where it's like really clear in the mix. There's not a lot of, there's a lot of like, it's kind of feels bare bones, I guess. And it's kind of just like stark, and like kind of dreary, I guess.
Yeah.
And then, but then the bass lines on the album are so like colorful and like, and there's so much movement. I don't know. I think it's sick.
I think you're really onto something with that. I think too often, all the emphasis is put like on the higher end.
Yeah.
And at some point it just gets like old, right?
Yeah.
But when you kind of have like that meek, small, like high end with like a really like colorful bass line.
Yeah.
I think it provides something.
Kind of, it just, for me, it strikes something deeper in my core.
In the core.
And yeah.
Well, you know.
I'm like an Apple bro.
It's the top of the hour, so I guess I'm going to drop station ID. Listen to KBS Davis. 90.3.
KBS Davis, 90.3 FM.
The next DJ is here, low-key. We might just hand it off.
We should just do that. I mean, we can play another song to make it to the transition easier. Yeah. Well, they'll be in shortly.
Okay. But
yeah.
You know what? I'm going to leave off with Duster, because that sounds good to me.
Heck yeah.
Thank you all for listening. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, as always.
Jack Twist deserved better.
Who's that?
I'm Jake Gyllenhaal from Brokeback Mountain.
Oh, I still haven't watched that movie.
Yeah, I just want to leave off on that.
We should watch it on air. When
okay. Yeah, we could do that.
What's up, dude?
But all right. Without further ado, goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Welcome one, welcome all to the, I think this is, what show is this? Let's see what show we're subbing in today. This is Lazy Lazy. You are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. Hello. I got to give a shout out to the prior two subs for really, coming in clutch, giving me a little bit of time to set up. What is this? Tuesday, Title 9 Arena. And you will likely have Lazy Lazy until 10:30, so you will also have me for Ride the Musical Airwaves. But first, we're going to be getting into some more favorable, let's say, reading. We're continuing where we left off last. I've been touching up on The Underworld by Journeys to the Depths of the Ocean. Before we get into that, I want to remind everybody the following views presented in this hour do not reflect the views of KDVS, KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. Awesome, awesome. Let's see what else we got down here. Sick, okay, live, Carty. All right. Looks like KDVS underwriting has already been attended for, so I might play that again just to be sure. And then see as well. Yeah, we're gonna fade a little here, and then we're gonna get into the underworld. But yeah, this is your host Lazy Lazy. You are listening to KDVS Davis 90.3 FM. Now that we got all of those fixins done, let's get straight into it. So, back to our prior music. I believe we are listening to some lovely classical, making sure that we have a proper setting for our book. I'm again reading The Underworld, Journeys to the Depths of the Ocean by Susan Casey. Let's get straight into it. For those, again, who love the ocean, last we stopped, we were learning a bit about what the deep is, how big it is, how it spans, I believe, 95% of the volume of the ocean. So, to continue, after reading about the Geelvink fracture zone, if those remember, it was an undersea network of national parks for giants, and until now, no one had known it existed. Reading about this fantastical seafloor, I found it impossible not to wonder, what else are we missing? What else is stashed in the abyss? And why aren't we dropping everything to find out? How much lost history is down there? How much knowledge, How many geological marvels? How many undescribed species? What kind of wild rumpus goes on below while we're preoccupied topside with our leveraged buyouts and political bickering and selfie apps? Nothing would be too unbelievable. In the deep, there are creatures that breathe iron, and creatures with glass skeletons, and creatures that communicate through their skin. Some of its creatures can turn themselves inside out. They might have two mouths, or three hearts, or eight legs. Or their bodies might consist of 1,000 little bodies, a coordinated army. At least one deep sea creature squirts yellow light. Some have see-through heads. Even the most ethereal among them can handle pressures that would crush a Mack truck. The deep's tiniest residents are the Earth's mightiest biological force. These are microbes. Yo, shout out the microbes. Bacteria, archaea, protists, and viruses. The single-celled organisms that power life's laboratory. They convert chemicals into energy, recycle carbon, supply oxygen, turn waste into nutrients, and chew up toxins, among countless other feats. We wouldn't be here without them. In the ocean, their numbers are so astronomical that we need to borrow a word from cosmology to estimate them, nonillion, or 10 to the 30th power. If all 3.6 nonillion marine microbes were gathered up and put on a scale, they would account for 90% of the ocean's biomass. Scientists don't know how many species they represent, possibly as many as a billion. There were microbes gusting from seafloor vents back when multicellular life was only a glimmer in the primordial eye. They've managed to thrive in brutally harsh conditions for eons. By studying their resilience, we've discovered new antibiotic and antiviral medicines, new biomaterials, new compounds for treating cancer, and new diagnostic tests, including the ones used for COVID-19. There's nothing anthropocentric about any of this. It's a full cast of aliens. But the deep's otherness is the essence of its enchantment, and it deserves to be appreciated on its own terms. To sense this world of water known to the creatures of the sea, we must shed our human perceptions of length and breadth and time and place, Rachel Carson wrote, with her usual poetic clarity. It would also be helpful if we could set aside our terrestrial bias, the mistaken belief that everything important happens above ground, because that's where we live. In fact, our survival depends on the ocean. The more we've delved downward, the more we've had to revise our ideas about how the Earth operates, how the climate behaves, what we can learn from the distant past, our place in the overall scheme of life, even our definition of life. Now it's apparent that nature runs as a massively interconnected system, with the deep sea as its motherboard. Yet even as we tinker with the machinery in potentially irreversible ways, we have only the foggiest notion of how it all works. The deep buffers our excess carbon, at least so far, drives the ocean's circulation and thus climate, regulates the Earth's geochemistry, important to put it mildly, and absorbs surplus heat, ditto, to cite just a few of its services. Humming away in obscurity, it's the foundation of the planet. This underworld is a thrilling mystery, but you'd never know it. In general, our culture is far more interested in space. For every dollar the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration spends on ocean exploration and research, NASA gets 150. We lavish billions on the prospect of colonizing Mars, a barren dust ball. The ocean's inner space is a harder sell, because humanity has the unfortunate habit of ignoring and fearing what it can't see. The solar system is directly overhead, visible through our eyes and telescopes, but the seafloor is beyond our immediate perception. To many, it's the Earth's haunted basement, sinister, shrouded in blackness, spewing molten rock and poisonous gases, a den of freaky beings and hoary specters. And they would rather stay upstairs. I swear that's in the book. The idea of a descent into anything unnerves us. We descend into madness, into grief, into chaos. we fall into disrepute, fall from grace, and even worse, fall into oblivion. We're hardwired to look upward, to head toward the light. Heaven is up there, in our opinion. If the stars should appear one night in 1,000 years, how would men believe and adore and preserve for many generations the remembrance of the city of God which had been shown? Ralph Waldo Emerson rhapsodized about the night sky, adding that the heavens awaken certain reverence, because though always present, they are inaccessible. So is the abyss, on both accounts, but it doesn't get the same adoration. Mountains, forests, rivers, ponds, trees, flowers, birds, clouds, stars. They've all been exalted in literature and poetry, in art, in music, in minds, in hearts. When the ocean makes an appearance, it's usually as a soothing backdrop, or a stormy surface, or a medium that reflects sunlight or moonlight in beguiling ways. On the rare occasion when the abyss is considered, it looms as a threat or a cautionary tale. In a word, it's abysmal. It's as if the deep were too remote, too frightening, too ugly to be lovable. But what if we have it upside down? What if the deeper you go, the more astonishing everything becomes? To me, that seemed like a compelling possibility, but there was only one way to know. I would need to make my own katabasis, to descend into the depths itself, myself, and return with the stories I found there. I knew this was easier said than done, but I also knew that technology was moving fast, enhancing our ability to study the abyss, and even to view it in person. Autonomous deep-sea robots with artificial intelligence, manned submersibles like zippy little spacecraft, seafloor observatories wired to the internet, scanners that sequence DNA in the water, new sonars, new sensors, new science, they're all here at last. And more breakthroughs are coming. As with any trip to an offbeat place, you can learn from those who've gone there before you. Certainly, I wasn't the only one drawn to the deep. A formidable group of explorers and scientists had left their own aquatic trails. Over the course of 5 years, I would seek them out, and ultimately, the journeys I took with them would lead me to the day when I would be poised to dive into the heart of the Pacific Ocean. Abyss. Some of these people were famous, others were quietly knowledgeable. All of them were intrepid. And they knew firsthand that to take such a plunge is to grapple with one of humanity's most intimidating and well-ingrained beliefs. If you dare to go down there, you may not come back. On that January day in 2021, as I stood on deck in the blustering wind, I was worried, but not about being lost in the deep. Despite the surly ocean conditions, despite the fact that the sub had experienced its share of mechanical problems, despite my awareness that we would be diving deeper than I'd ever dreamed of, I intended to come back. I had faith in the whole operation. At that moment, my only concern was whether I would get to go. Chapter zero. Prologue, in fact. That was not even them properly diving down. That was simply the prologue prior to their descent into the abyss. Magnus's Monsters. We're gonna be going right into Magnus's Monsters quite soon. We're gonna take a little breaky break real quick. But keep listening to the soothing classical. This is Lazy Lazy popping out for just a moment. Thank you. Welcome back, y'all. We're going to continue reading Chapter 1, Magnus's Monsters. Indeed, I should also add that monsters, some long familiar, some unprecedented, are sighted off of Norway, and this is due particularly to the unfathomable depth of the waters. Olaus Magnus, Uppsala, Sweden. If you were searching for world-famous deep-sea monsters, a stately building at the top of a hill in Uppsala, Sweden, is not the first place you would look. But the monsters are here, behind the butter-colored facade and tall windows of Uppsala University's oldest library, an institution known as Karolina Rediviva. The university was established in 1477. Uppsala, a charming city about an hour north of Stockholm, has been around for even longer. It was a Viking stomping ground in the first millennium, a hub of feisty Norse pagans who worshipped the gods of thunder and wind and war while enjoying the odd human sacrifice before Christianity moved in. There's a lot of history in Uppsala, but I had come to see one particular relic, the Karta Marina, a 16th century illustrated map that depicts the North Atlantic, North Sea, and Norwegian Sea regions, and the fiendish creatures that, according to the map's authors, lived in those waters. For as long as people have gazed out at the ocean, they've shivered at the thought of its silent inhabitants. The word abyss, translated from its Greek roots, means without bottom. What kind of ungodly beast would find such a place hospitable? It was hard to imagine what such a thing might look like, though religion and mythology offered chilling descriptions and comparisons to Satan. So when someone created a map of the sea that featured portraits of these residents, it was sure to attract attention. The Karta Marina was printed in 1539, and at a glance it was no boring document. Every inch of its 23 square foot surface was covered with intricate drawings, landmarks, labels, directions, and notes written in a cramped Latin script. The map was packed with its era's latest intelligence about natural history, geography, marine life, ocean conditions, navigation, shipping routes, and local customs. It charted Scandinavia, an isolated part of the world at that time, with unprecedented accuracy. But the reason I flew to Sweden to see the Karta Marina is because it's a 480-year-old snapshot of the prevailing fears and beliefs about the deep ocean. Beyond its cartography, it's a map of perceptions. In an age before science, before deep sea exploration, before high-definition underwater cameras, what people overwhelmingly believed about the deep was that it was filled with monsters. And the Karta Marina made their presence official. It portrayed their malice in striking detail. From Greenland all the way to Norway, menacing creatures are shown lolling in the water, wreaking havoc on the ships, devouring sailors, and in general behaving badly. Having risen from the hellish pit of the abyss, and intent on dragging their victims back down there. Adding to the map's authority came from a trustworthy source. Its creator, a Catholic priest and historian named Olaus Magnus, was born in Linköping, Sweden, in 1490. Magnus led a cosmopolitan life, attending university in Germany, traveling widely throughout Europe. For a while, he was based in Poland. He roamed the northern countries as a papal ambassador, collecting fees for the church and soaking up information. First-hand observations, stories from villagers, maritime insights from fishermen and sailors, and regional gossip seasoned from a dash of medieval superstition. People have always been scared of the deep. But in Magnus's time, there we go, it evoked an extra degree of terror. In the moody north, the ocean was often visibly furious, and from shore it would have appeared endless, its edge unknown. Ships would leave and never come back. Mariners vanished into its maw, sinking into an underworld that was crawling with demons like Leviathan and the Kraken. Aside from the unlucky souls who'd visited the abyss on a one-way trip, no one had ever seen it. No one knew anything about it. To the average person, it was a tabula rasa of doom. But even back then, how could anyone or not wonder what was hidden there? Maybe Atlantis. We'll never know when or where the earliest efforts to learn more about the deep occurred. Somewhere in ancient Oceania would be my guess. But in Western culture, the Greek philosopher Aristotle is credited as the first marine biologist. He dissected any aquatic creatures he could get his hands on in the 14th century BCE, spent years studying their behavior in a lagoon, and presented his findings in a book called Historia Animalium, History of Animals. Among other observations, Aristotle noted that cuttlefish change color when they're startled, and that female sharks tend to be larger than male sharks. He figured out how lobsters copulate. He's also discerned that whales and dolphins are mammals. Wow. That's pretty impressive. Classifying them in a group he named cetaceae, from the Greek word cetos, or sea monster. The Roman historian Pliny the Elder followed in 77 CE, publishing a 37-volume encyclopedia that contained notes, musings, and wild conjecture about marine life. Unlike Aristotle, who relied on empirical evidence, Pliny spouted sea monster lore, holding forth about 300-foot-long eels, man-eating octopuses, and fish the size of islands. In fact, he declared, most of the deep's inhabitants were of monstrous form. He wrote of submarine hurricanes that stirred up the ocean from the very bottom, and the monsters are driven from their depths and rolled upwards on the crest of the billow. Aristotle's work was substantial and rigorous, but Pliny's tall tales were more popular. Throughout the Middle Ages, while Aristotle's anatomical diagrams were mostly forgotten, Pliny was considered the main authority. But still, the deep remained far out of reach. I noticed the time it is, so I'm going to call the book closed. This has been your host, Lazy Lazzy. You're not getting rid of me just yet. I will be sticking around for Ride the Musical Airwaves this next hour. You've been listening to, in this past half hour, Title IX Arena. Thank you so much, audience, for listening. I will be taking a short intermission and then hopping back on for some more music. Thank you very much.
Engineering or physical science majors? Need help finding a job? The Internship and Career Center can help. Come down to 210 South Hall for assistance with AggieTracks, resumes, cover letters, finding jobs online, and prepping for interview questions. For more information, please call 530-752-2819 or go to www.icc.ucdavis.edu.
Welcome one, welcome all to the Ride the Musical Airwaves show with your host, Lazy Lazzy. Today we're going to be playing some jazz, today and later today as well, if you are so inclined. I will be hosting, I'll be subbing in 3 to 5 p.m. later today, and I will be playing more of some of my jazz picks. So, we're going to get straight into it with Bogota from, let's see what this guy's name is. Counter Time Inner Space by Ahmad Jamal. All right, let's get straight into it.